we asked ChatGPT to generate some questions to try to create a better understanding of Bill's model and to maybe try to poke some holes in his model. So we'll be discussing those things and more today on this week's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Anytime you work within a model that's coherent and seems to be useful for everything and is super helpful and seems to be better than anything you've done before, it's very hard to not develop a strong bias.
You think?
Unbelievably strong bias.
It is so strong.
And that's even something that people have talked to me about outside of this is how do you know you're not just strongly biasing yourself away from trying all these other things? Well, because all of this stuff has been the most useful stuff that I've ever used. Before I could help somebody with an issue in 2 weeks, and now I can do it in 20 minutes, I'm not really going to try to pursue anything else because what's next? Am I going to help them in 10 minutes? Yeah, I guess, but well, why wouldn't I just hone in on that thing that seems to be the most effective? Yeah. So that's kind of where I am with that. A little backstory. This whole process is of us together creating these courses, developing out a framework for certification, trying to put this stuff together in like mixed book format type of thing. You utilize AI and ChatGPT to help us sort of compile information, look for holes, make some connections that we might not be able to make. I asked it to generate some questions to try to help understand the model better or even to poke holes in what's currently the model.
Sure.
One of the things it was trying to understand, what I've found in the last few weeks of using this is that a lot of the questions that it asks are also the questions that we get from practitioners. It might be that this certain topics or questions are things that really need to be delved into a little deeper or with more detail. Let's just start with one of them here. So in terms of philosophical orientation reasoning, how do you differentiate between a model, a framework, and a lens in your reasoning process? And how does the UHPC model fulfill those three different roles? So model, framework, and lens.
Well, they're probably more similar than different. However, you have something that is sort of the all-encompassing representation. And then within that, there is the decision-making element of it that would be that I would probably associate more with like the framework versus the model. So the model is sort of like, okay, everything that fits into this is sort of grouped together. And then there's a structure within that. That would be the framework within the model. And then if I have a perspective, then I see things through that frame of reference, right? And so they're all talking about the same thing. It's just a matter of like how closely am I looking at this, right? If I'm stepping back and I'm trying to see this whole thing, that would be the representative model. It's like everything that is contained, right? Structure is the framework, and then the perspective of me using this in a context would be lens.
Yeah, the context part is the lens, right?
I think so. Because anything beyond that is just generalized at this point, right? Like until I apply it within a context, then I can't utilize the perspective, right?
Right. And this might just be my misunderstanding, but I've always thought of frameworks as something you could hang your already existing mental models on.
Maybe, but I would say that let me offer you this. If you looked at this just popped into my head, so maybe this is like way out there. If you look at the structure of a cell, okay, so you look at a cell, and within that cell, there is a framework, right? There is physical structure within, like literally, it's a tensegrity, really, within the cell itself. It has a structure. So it does have a framework that maintains this structure of the cell. What we look at something as this all-encompassing thing, right? And so the cell would be representative of the model. Within it, the cell has a structure that would be the framework, right? So that's how I would look at it.
So do the principles and concepts become the framework?
They are within the framework. Yes.
Okay.
But I don't think they necessarily become the framework, right? Because you have process within that as well, right? Which may not fall into that category. Because when you look at the way I've drawn it out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the three P's.
Yeah. So we have principles, we have process, and then we have practices, right? And so each one of those is within, you know, within the entire structure of the model, but there might be like separate frameworks, in fact, within that, right? Because I have process, and then I have practices, which, you know, I have a sequence of events, and then I have within that, I would have the tools that are being applied within that sequence, right? So each one would sort of have like an element of framework to it in my mind.
So is a model more of like a 30,000 foot view?
Yeah. Like what would support the model? It's like, it would be the framework that would be within it, right?
I'm imagining as you zoom in, you get more of like the spider charts and the this then this scenario, and those are your framework.
If-thens and
The lens is I take the model and the framework and I use it to view whatever I'm looking at.
Correct.
And the information in front of me. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Same philosophical and reasoning category. In what ways do you see the tension between complexity and probability shaping your clinical decisions, especially in cases where outcomes are non-linear or appear emergent?
Well, they don't appear emergent. They are emergent. As far as I can tell, it would have to be emergent. This is just, okay, so this is decision-making framework 101 kind of stuff. Right.
So, which I didn't actually load that transcript into the GPT.
Okay. So. I was going to say that would probably be the next thing to load in there. This is a problem. When you're dealing with complexity, there is still a cause and an effect that is within the complexity. The problem is that in a complex situation, it is only determined in hindsight. So that just means you got to do something and you got to see what happens. And then based on what happens, that leads you to the next do something. So, you know, you intervene in a situation. So you identify what you think is going on, you intervene, and then there is a result. And then based on that result, in our case, when we're talking about movement, that's just behavior. So all we're doing is we're determining the behavioral outcome, and then that leads us to the next step. So it's just this repeating process. But it doesn't mean that we can't determine what's going on. It just means that we actually have to sort of poke the system, right? And see what it does. And then what it does tells us what to do next.
So these are questions about structure and adaptation. How do you conceptualize structural change like bone torsions or pelvic shifts as part of the adaptive movement process versus is compensatory failure? And when does the model treat these changes as reversible versus non-reversible?
Okay. I don't perceive a failure. Everything that we see is going to be an attempt to solve a problem. So these are all solutions, whether we like them or not, right? And people will classify things using the D word, which really we shouldn't, right? There's nothing that's dysfunctional. It's just like, maybe you just don't understand what's going on, right? And so then you go, I don't understand this. It's not what I want it to be. That's dysfunction. It's like, okay, well, that's a little bit of a cop-out. We should probably work a little bit harder to try to determine what is. And so you have constraints that determine what the options are. And then the system decides, it's like, okay, I have to solve this problem. I will use whatever means necessary that I have available. And it would take the most efficient course of action. Knowing full well that every time that it tries to solve a problem, the options are progressively reduced because I can't increase beyond what the constraints will allow, right? So I have affordances in the environment. I have constraints within the system. Those are going to interact in a certain way. And so when you look at any form of adaptation, whether it be hypertrophy that's trying to solve a problem of protection against the stressors that we would apply with strength training or whatever. Everything is going to be about, okay, can the system survive under the circumstances? And so it's going to try to solve that problem. And so those are just normal consequences based on what the constraints will allow, right? But it helps us determine how aggressively and how hard the system is actually working in this circumstance, which is, again, to our advantage. What we need to understand is the process of how someone arrived at point B. So we have foundational archetypes that help us determine what point A is, and then we can deconstruct this from point B to point A. So that is the reversibility. So we would say that we would reverse engineer this process to get back as close as we can to whatever the foundational archetype, if that's the goal, right? Depending on what our intentions are, right? And so, but there would be potential adaptations that are relatively permanent, depending on how aggressively they're applied, the duration from which they're applied, because there are certain adaptations. Like, just take like a trabecular behavior at the ends of bones as they're compressed, and then bone density increases, and then you have a structural change that really you can't reverse. You can't reconstruct those trabeculae. So we have subchondral bone density that increases. We have arthritic conditions that would follow. It's like, okay, we're not going to be able to change that. That's non-reversible, right? And so those situations do arise. And so we have to take that kind of an adaptation into consideration. And then there's going to be situations where, again, the bony adaptations are so significant, we're not going to reverse those. But prior to those types of elements, there are many things that we can reverse. We can, you know, a lot of the torsion is going to reduce like water content in tissues. So you take a tendinopathy. A tendinopathy is a situation where we have altered that state. And if I can actually reduce the muscle orientation or joint position that is creating that state, I potentially reduce the tension on that tissue. That tissue is now capable of reabsorbing water. We restore the state of the connective tissues, and depending on how long it's been there, how much degeneration is taking place, et cetera, right? But I mean, there are situations that we can't reverse, but there are many that are reversible, at least to a degree that would be beneficial.
Okay. All right. So here's another one more about like the evolution of the model. This is a question I bring up to you, and I know the answer to this, but has there been any formal attempt to try to falsify any of the foundational principles of the model? Example, like movement is shape change, or health and performance is being distinct. And if not, how do you know that they aren't just heuristics versus actual principles?
You're saying you're comparing them to heuristics versus principle?
It's asking, so the GPT is asking if you've done anything to try to question the foundational principles.
Every day?
Sure, but it's asking you if you haven't really tried to poke holes in it, how do you know that they're not just like rules of thumb that you're using that aren't really principle-based?
Well, I don't know that we could ever really tell. I mean, we've got comparisons of other strong sciences that are principle based that the model is coherent with like that. And that's intentional because I want to make sure that we are following the most coherent path when we're making decisions, but we're in a constant state of test, retest and determination of what is. And so the way that we arrive at something that would be representative of closer to truth is like, okay, well, how many times have you done something like this as an intervention and gotten a high probabilistic result? So I hesitate to use the word predictive because it implies the accuracy, right? And what we want to do is we want to continue to shift probability in our favor. And it's like, so the more times you do something when you're presented with a similar situation, and the more times that outcome is closer to like 100% probability, then we're getting closer and closer to the truth. And so that's basically what has happened over time, right? And then it's a matter of understanding. Like the movement as shape change is kind of a big deal because what we have done previously is we've looked at measures, especially like in assessment measures, as something that is measured with any reasonable accuracy. What we're actually measuring is a shape change, which from a physical principle standpoint, if you go to like, you know, and this sounds really far out and crazy, like you get into like quantum theory and such, it's like, okay, those are energetic. Those are, like, you talk about particle behavior, that's shape change based on energy. And it's like, so, okay, so if that's the foundational principle at the smallest level, and we're made out of that stuff, it's like, we have to sort of follow that principle too. And so what we end up looking at, instead of saying like this joint motion is the joint moving, it's actually just a shape change. And that shape change actually occurs based on the propagation of energy through the system. And that's literally how it works. And so now we have this coherence with, we have these physical principles that exist in the universe. And it's like, well, how are we recognizing that in human movement? And that's what it is. And that's how this shape change is related to movement. It's just a transfer of energy. And it's like, this is how we recognize this on a, if we looked at particle to human, it's like from micro to macro.
Yeah. I mean, it is, to follow up with that, are there any aspects of the model? I know the answer is yes, but are there any aspects of the model that when you look at it, you're like, this might be wrong. In 10 years, I might not think this anymore. Or you're not sure.
I don't think that way. I think it's more of like the discovery.
Yeah, because it's always this discovery phase, right?
It is. And that's how it's been. When you think about, okay, when we're looking at chessboards and things like that, it's like the interpretation of the chessboard is an evolution, because you have to recognize the fact that like, this doesn't fit what I thought it was, right? Because I fail. I mean, you just go in, and all you have to do is fail miserably enough times, and you go, okay, why is this not working? I mean, that's what drove this whole thing in the first place, is like the failures were still too frequent. But if you fail and then you recognize this, and then you keep asking questions, you say, well, what are the possibilities and what are the options? And then we slow, like I said, you're constantly testing, retesting, and you're getting closer and closer to say, oh, what I was thinking was this is actually something else. And so it's you've heard me say this a good gajillion times, the model evolved today, right?
Yeah,
because it was, oh, it's just recognition of, I just didn't consider that as a possibility before, and now you recognize, like, okay, this is still within the constraints of the possibility. I just right. didn't recognize it before for what it actually is. And then it's like, okay, got to go back, reframe. And it's like, okay, here's the updated sequence of events. Like, this is what's possible.
Yeah. I think a good example, just from my exposure to the model early on, I think I came to the third intensive, mm-hmm. and then we're approaching the 24th.
Fourth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the third intensive, movement was described in a way where there was this load and propeller, dichotomy, right?
And it's still there. It's still there. It's just a better description.
Right. Yeah. So before it was you load, and it was really based off of like a lot of the previous models that had come before, and it made sense to make it into that. And then it was just, well, if I look at movement in terms of walking, there's this early, middle, and late. So why wouldn't that just be coherent with propulsion? And then it was, I don't know if that's how you arrived at it, but that's how I've sort of reconciled it in my head. Yeah. So it's sort of that way it was presented wasn't wrong. It was still useful. No. It was wrong. It was still useful. Always was useful. It's just it wasn't the most coherent.
It wasn't the best descriptor. And again, this actually goes back to the shape change and then the concept of phase transition, because what a phase transition is a shape change, right?
Yes.
It's a representation of a shape change. It's not all, but it was just a recognition of, I was looking at the external application more so than the internal representation.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, right? Because I was using the exterior. It's like, okay, that's where the loading comes from, right? So that's the force application. But the reality is like, okay, while it exists, it's not a descriptor of the system. Like, the system behavior is what's different, because we were using a physical principle that exists, which, again, that's why it still worked as a representation, but it wasn't the descriptor of how the system was behaving during that process. And that's all. Yeah. That's what we've changed is like, okay, we're just describing the system behavior.
Well, it's where the quantum stuff starts to sneak in, where you have the superimposition and superposition things, everything happening at the same time, what quantity of which is happening and qualitatively how it's happening is only based on when you measure it.
And that's a really tough one for folks to grasp. But I'm not a quantum physicist, just for the record. And I read comic books about quantum physics, so I understand it.
Right. Well, here's to hoping that
to some degree.
Here's to hoping that in our
I know who Bohr is and all those guys,
Feynman and those guys.
It's like I'm at comic book level, right? As far as the understanding, but at least you can see the coherence, especially with the concept of like the wave collapse of the measurement, right? And then the superposition, the fact that both exist until you measure, and then the representative strategy is recognized. And that's what the actual measurements are, right? That's how we do it. It's like until you as the measurer, right? You're interacting with a system, and it's like until you do something to them, you are now the constraint. Like you're the external constraint that produces a behavior. That's literally what a measurement is. And it's like, until you interact with that system, all possibilities exist. And then you measure, and then the wave function collapses. And then that's the measurement. That's literally how it works, which is kind of cool. And, and it sounds like again, space, it's like, there's going to be people listening to this go, oh, this is total bullshit. And it's like, you guys are just making stuff up. So it sounds really smart. It's like, no, it's like, we're looking for coherence. And I am perfectly fine with you deciding that I'm measuring a shoulder. So every time I measure shoulder, I'm measuring shoulder. That's great. Okay. I don't care. I really don't care. It's like, as long as, you know, you're doing the best that you can do for someone and you're comfortable with it and everybody else is comfortable, it's like, great, live your life. It's like, you know, I'm okay with it.
Right.
But, you know, it's like, and, you know, if you want to push the envelope and you want to make progress and, you know, you want to see what the possibilities are, you got to hang your ass out there and you got to be stupid.
Well, do you finally want to understand your failures, or do you want to just, you want to just toss them out and say that that's not your fault, or you did everything you could, so it should have worked, but it just didn't, and you're just unlucky.
I don't discount anyone's honorable intentions.
Well, I don't want to be competing against luck. I don't want to just say if something didn't go the way I expected it to, that it's unlucky. I believe that there always going to be a reason that you don't know of, that you might not have understood before, for why that was happening or why it continues to happen. We hear this sort of thing all the time. Clinicians that have their really tough cases are always this thing. Like, they always have a problem with TMJ left shoulder people, and they can't seem to crack it, even though they're doing all the stuff that they learned that seems to work for right shoulders or whatever it is, and they're banging their heads against the wall. You can either shrug your shoulders and just refer out when it comes to those type of issues, or you can look deeper at it. Hang your ass out there, figure out what you're doing wrong or what you're misunderstanding, and then get better.
I'm too old to be concerned about judgment.
Yeah. Well, you can't care about that
at this point. You know, I'm so close to death. Who cares?
And so much people want to say that we're trying to sound smart, or we're trying to make people buy stuff, but so much of this stuff is free. Like, this episode of us talking about this is all free. The hours and hours of content on the network are free. You can choose to go deeper if you would like. We allow you to do that. And that might cost you some money. But like, as anything, when it comes to mentorship or learning something, it's an investment. Yeah. Anyways. we're talking a lot about the principles and concepts here. And we're having ChatGPT sort of ask some questions to tease out, maybe try to poke some holes or to tease out any sort of gaps in understanding that it might have, or anyone might have, really, when it comes to this stuff. A lot of this comes from Bill. Just recently finished a principles and concepts course on the UHP network. So if you're listening to this and you haven't heard of that before, we will be doing another one of those live principles and concepts cohorts in July of 2025, depending on when you watch this. So get signed up for the UHP network. It's free. You can be informed about when
the
that
network
course
is free, not the course.
Yes, I was about to get to that. Since people are very quick to misunderstand. The courses, The principles and concepts course, there is a fee for that because it is a live 8-week course.
Yes.
But actually, are we doing 9? I don't remember. Are we doing 9 weeks?
We'll figure it out.
We're doing 9 weeks this time.
Yeah.
The network is free. If you want to learn more about when that's happening, sign up for it. Take it to learn the stuff that is the fundamentals of this model. Then, if you think that you're interested in biomechanics, and you take a course where you don't actually learn where any of the biomechanical concepts come from, take this course because it will actually give you a background in where that stuff comes from. Principles-based, foundational-based. Okay.
Yeah. That was a commercial, right?
That was a commercial. Well, people don't know. I'm sure there are people
it's
that
It's okay.
Have,
I mean,
yeah,
we
got
to tell
podcast.
Them. It's like there might be you know, the 6 people that listen to this will probably be interested.
Right. Can you clearly differentiate where the model ends and abductive reasoning begins during a case application? So the example offered is, when does a clinical choice cease to be model-driven and become practitioner-dependent improvisation?
Okay, so it's always abductive reasoning because we never have full knowledge. So
right.
That's an absolute. Like we can use, you know, induction and deduction, obviously. There's going to be certain elements that we could consider more objective than others, but we're never fully informed. So we're always in abductive reasoning. And then there might be some experiential things that you might do intuitively by pattern recognition, which would be sort of like the creative element, right? Where you may not have an understanding, you may not have what you consider a viable intervention. And so once again, you're running your safe to fail experiments in this realm of complexity. And so then you do that without a deep reason, right? But you may have a sense that, okay, I'm just going to try this. And that's okay too, because there's so much stuff we don't know. And then you can sort of reverse engineer your process. You look at your potential cause and effect, and then, but that's kind of how you reason your way through stuff that you just don't know. And there's plenty of scenarios where we just don't know.
Yeah. Right?
We are making our, I hesitate to use the word guess but occasionally it is, right? It's an educated guess is what we would be using in that circumstance. And so, like I said, you're never fully informed. There will be times where, you know, you're going to do something for seemingly no reason. It just kind of makes sense. Or you're just going to do something, right, just to get the system to respond. Because think about this. There will be scenarios where there is poorly defined constraints, right? Especially like take somebody with an injury where you don't have an MRI, you don't have an X-ray, like you don't have any diagnostics. Like somebody just comes to you and they say, yeah, I haven't been to the doctor or whatever. It's like, I've had this injury thing. It's like, there are so many unknowns in that circumstance that again, this is where you're going to poke the system. You just say, well, let me see what happens, right? I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that. I think that's probably what this question would be.
Yeah, and the next question is kind of related. It asks about how do you account for emergent failure across subsystems that don't show up in movement, especially when movement remains adaptable under certain pathology. That I don't know initially if I agree with that last statement that it says, but I think when you're dealing with people, right, one of the big components of that is going to be communication and this sort of psychosocial interrelationship that you have with that person. Yeah. And you can tell when someone's coming in, if they're very stressed, they respond to certain things in a certain way psychologically, that you're going to have to change how you want to treat this person. If they have very strong beliefs and opinions about certain things, even if you know that this activity or this therapy is going to be proper for them to do in order to get the outcome you're looking for, you're going to have to change it.
Yeah.
So it's that component. We don't necessarily talk about being a good person and how to communicate really well with people as part of the model. We have suggested people read books like How to Win Friends and Influence People and just, you know, mm-hmm. come from the right parents and being raised in a way that makes you yes. into what you could classify as a good person. Yeah. But a lot of that needs to be learned, I think. People aren't inherently given that or aren't brought up in an environment where they just sort of learn that through osmosis.
Well, it's an uncomfortable situation for a lot of people.
Yeah, like, for sure.
Like you could be interested in science, like very interested in science. And you could say, okay, I'm not going to talk about myself here. Didn't like the one-on-one interaction. Like my mother to this day is fascinated by the fact that I do what I do because she says, you just don't like people enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, she thought I was being an accountant locked in a room, you know, like just punching numbers and I'd be perfectly happy. And I kind of live that way inside of the office. Right. But no, it's like I had to learn to get comfortable with the interaction and I still suck at it, you know, on a regular basis, but better than I was before. And I'm much more comfortable with it now. Right. But that's part of an evolutionary process of the practitioner.
Yeah.
Like some people are great with it, like right off the bat. They're maybe great conversationalists, or they're a little bit more, you know, outgoing as far as personality goes, or they have a little less concern over judgment and things like that.
Call it emotional intelligence, call it ability to read the room, call it, you know,
it's a bunch of little
personal
things.
Communication.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of little things that you might just have to evolve.
Yeah.
But they're just skills. I mean, they're just skills that you learn over time.
Sure. And I think our expectation is someone coming in to learn the UHPC model is that that's already taken care of, that we don't necessarily have to, you don't have to create that. The practitioners coming to the model, we hope that gravitate towards the model are those mm-hmm. people already. But yeah. Lisa, that's our hope, so that we don't have to sit them down and be like, this is why you need to stop being a psychopath.
Tad extreme, but okay.
Yeah, but you know,
I understand by definition.
Yeah, if you're a narcissist and a psychopath, it's going to be very difficult for you to relate to a lot of these people,
yes.
and you're going to lose clients and not really understand why because you're too much of a narcissist. So
everybody has said the wrong thing at the wrong time or made the wrong joke, or you know, you try to make light of a situation and somebody interprets it a different way,
right? Because like, you don't know their experience.
Right.
Necessarily.
Right. And it just happens. It's like, you know, it doesn't make you a bad person. That just means you screwed up in that scenario.
And this goes back to what we were mentioning earlier. It's a matter of what do you do with that response and that information? Do you learn from it and take accountability, say, I made the wrong choice here, I need to adjust in the future? Or do I just get rid of that client and just bring someone else in that does like my dirty humor or whatever it might be, you know?
Yes.
I think some people do take the latter. They take the latter as their choice because they would rather just work with people that allow them to stay in their little hole, not evolve, not change their attitude, not change how they interact with people. And that and might be how they work. Yeah.
But that's fine. That's fine.
And that's just, you know, that's just not what we're trying to accomplish.
No.
Let's see here. It would be a good, there's a lot here. So we'll be able to do like multiple episodes of this probably. I think we found a certain type of people that like this stuff and they keep watching the stuff. And there are trolls that come into our YouTube comment section every once in a while. So if you want
They're great because it's like,
so funny.
No, the funniest thing is like, okay, so there's two things that are incredibly valuable that you cannot replace, and that is your time and your attention. And it's like they give it all to us.
Yeah.
It's like we're so important.
You just
need to save the world from you guys.
Quickly, just try to get through these last two on strategy, application, mm-hmm. and energetics. Could you walk through a case example where you tracked the systemic drift, which is something that you've kind of brought up as a concept recently on the network?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've tracked their drift via movement, behavior, breathing, energetic thresholds, et cetera, and use that to redirect the client's trajectory before that adaptation, compensation, or collapse happened.
Well, that all you're talking about now is process.
Yeah.
Right. So what we're actually identifying so we're actually determining the magnitude, if you will, of the drift as far as what direction that they're going. So, but this lends itself to foundational archetypes, and then the biases that are associated with that. So we have a probabilistic behaviors that are associated with the constraints. So the way that you're designed is going to determine like what your options are. And then the more extreme those constraints are, then the much easier they are to identify, which is why we use them, because they help guide this process. And so it helps us determine like, okay, so when we talk about the drift, So these are the behaviors that are very subtle, and they occur over a period of time, right? So it's not instantaneous, but it sometimes appears that way. So the things change gradually over time, and then you will slowly reach a point where you will hit what would be represented in dynamical systems as an attractor, right? Where the probability is that you're going to go in this direction, you're going to end up in this spot, which would be a behavior. So it'd be like a pelvic position, a hip motion, right? The superimposition of internal rotation on external rotation in some way, shape, or form. And so that's essentially what we're measuring in process. And again, because we know what the starting conditions, we know what the starting conditions would be based on archetype, then that's how we're using this to create the reversibility of this behavior, and eliminate before we get to the point where the drift has occurred, and then you get this massive collapse of behavior, and then that becomes this really hardcore type of an orientation where now we've got a progressive load that would produce an adaptation that could change structure, which is what we don't want to get into that pickle. It does happen, obviously, but we're just talking about process in that respect, I think.
Yeah. Can you think of anything, any recent examples of cases you've had where this was something you were tracking and trying to redirect?
I have a representation on a basketball player that actually just happened this week that I had never seen him do before. And it was a scenario where, because of scheduling and his play schedule, we couldn't hook up. We tried to hook up periodically, right? And so I think we went like almost 6 weeks or something like that where I couldn't see him. And he showed up with a magnification of a behavior and then an additional behavior on top of that, which was like, it's a progression of turn, just another magnitude of turn that I'd never seen before. Because in his mind, his symptoms that he would typically get from playing basketball that he was managing well had flip-flopped. And he goes, it used to be a right side thing and now it's a left side thing. And it's like what it was just an extreme further progression of his behavior that he had never experienced before. And, you know, he's 30 years old, getting close to 30, I think. And he played a lot more minutes than he ever has before, but he also had the best season he's ever had. So that was kind of cool. But we saw some things that we just hadn't seen before, which again, right. it's just a further representation of what his constraints allow.
Okay. Was he trying? So a lot of times when I have situations like this where a client starts to experience something on the other side that's the same, they try to attack it using similar strategies.
He was using we had a sequence of events sequence of interventions that we used previously, and he said he goes I've been doing this religiously and it's not helping, and it's like, yeah, that's because we have another problem. And then so we literally, thankfully, I saw him soon enough, it was easily reversible. In fact, I mentioned this. It's like, so the concern I have is that this went really, really easily. So we got to be careful that you don't slip back, because when you make an easy change in somebody, it's probably indicative of the fact that they could change it very quickly in the opposing direction. And so we put the kibosh on that. And then we used the previous activities that he had been given. And then it works like a charm, because those were based on another representation. So what we had to do was arrest what we had seen additionally. We got him back to the place where we saw him last time, and then the previous interventions were effective again.